If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi, Stacey Cole, and Todd Michaels.
And the easiest thing to do when you don't know the answer is to fill in the blanks with who likely could be have something to do with this. Well, this family's up to no good in a lot of things, so maybe it's them. And then that's how you get, you know, the cascade of everything. I thought it was interesting how they portrayed it in the new series. Let's talk about Becky Hill as we continue to talk with Eric Faddis, defense attorney, former prosecutor, about the Alec Murdaugh case. And we're getting a step closer to possibly getting a retrial. We're in the process right now of, okay, it's going to the Supreme Court and they have to make some decisions, whether they're going to hear oral arguments or not, or if it's dead on arrival. We're now waiting for that. Let's talk about Becky Hill, one of the big reasons for all this, the clerk who handled the jury, helped coordinate logistics, and later wrote a book about the case that was pulled because she plagiarized some of it. One juror swore Hill told them to watch Alec's body language and don't be fooled. The defense says that alone destroyed the verdict. The state calls it a passing comment that changed nothing legally and practically. How big of a problem is that, Eric?
Jeez.
You know, that's the question with which the Supreme Court is going to wrestle, because, you know, one, was it a problem in the trial? It appears from the hearing on it and everything else, the transcript, that it was a problem, that she did engage in some kind of misconduct. So the next question is, how big of a problem in the trial was it? Was it what's called harmless error, meaning that he would have been convicted even absent that happening? That's what the prosecution is saying. Whereas defense is saying, no, not only is it not harmless, it's in fact what's called structural error. What defense is saying is that this was such an egregious violation of Alec Murdaugh's rights that it poisoned the entire trial. The outcome cannot be relied upon. We got to have a do-over. That's what defense is saying.
That was a gutsy thing for her to do. I mean, what would provoke her to think that she could get away with something like this? Do you think she's probably done this before and gotten away with it? Or just, I'm going to step out and do this to influence this trial? Or do you think this was just how it's done there?
You know, what we're talking about is the low country out there in South Carolina. And like Tony said earlier, there's sort of a good old boys mentality. And in some rural jurisdictions I've seen where folks are a little too close in terms of the court system and how they're interacting with jurors and their preconceived notions. And sometimes in smaller jurisdictions, it's a comment and nothing really comes of it. But due to the magnifying glass that was on this trial, I think her stepping out of line there came to the forefront when it might not have in the past. And, you know, is this the first time she's ever talk to jurors about a trial while the trial's going on? The first time she's ever done that in her life and she happened to get popped for it? Seems unlikely.
Yeah, exactly.
Is it gutsy or just ignorant? I mean, because sometimes gutsy, I think, can be confused with ignorance. You know, there's people that'll say stupid shit all the time. And then you're like, some of them are like, oh, wow, they're saying that. That's gutsy. If you don't know what they are, and then it, like, you look at their track record and it's like, that's not gutsy. They just don't know when to shut the F up.
I mean,
to me, that kind of feels like this. But regardless of what's going on in the back of her mind, what's running this machine, that doesn't matter. What matters is what came out of her mouth and then how it affected a juror or jurors or did not. The state's argument is basically, even if she said it, the evidence was strong enough to outweigh it. That's a dangerous precedent to set. It's basically saying that if the evidence is strong enough in any case, our clerk of court can pretty much say anything they want to you, and the evidence will stand on its own. You don't have to. She's not going to weigh on you. Why? Because we're saying she's not going to weigh on you. That's not how this works.
No, you can't unhear it.
You make such an important point, and in fact, that similar point is echoed in the defense's appellate brief, where they say, hey, look, prosecution wants you to just ignore this and say, hey, it was no big deal. But if we did that, we'd have a system, you know, that'd be the same as saying, hey, what if Becky just paid this juror to vote guilty? You know, what if she engaged in some further misconduct? If the rationale is that, oh, well, there was a ton of evidence, so who cares? That undermines, you know, the sort of fundamental structure of the entire system and the reliability that the public places in.
What I'm troubled by is where it's sitting, because we did learn in the last round of hearings where Gene Toll basically, you know, punted it down the line a little bit, literally got on football clothing, a uniform, and she went out there, put Alec Murdaugh's face on a football and punted it outside of the Colleton County Courthouse. It was quite a scene, and she made the field goal. It was quite a neat. But in all seriousness, she punted it down the line, and basically saying, you know, I don't find that there's, you know, anything that went wrong here, even though we had a juror that flat out said, no, she said this, and it affected me. How is it where the judge or the system can be the person that decides what is truly affecting someone or not, when the very person that they're asking, did this affect you or not, says, yes, this affected me. And they can go back and say, nah, it didn't. Right. Then why'd you ask?
I've contended from the very beginning that the judge got it wrong on the motion for a new trial. And, you know, in the appellate brief for defense, they cite to the transcript where they're asking this juror about this statement. The juror confirms that the statement was made, that, you know, don't be fooled by the defendant who was exercising his constitutional right to testify. And then they ask the juror, hey, point blank, did this affect your verdict? Did this influence you to vote guilty? And according to the transcript in the brief, the juror said yes. And so, for a judge to sort of second guess, what are they contending, that the juror was lying under oath about this thing that is probably very, you know, chaotic and traumatic for them, they didn't ask to be involved in. It seems like the judge was sort of substituting their own feelings about the case and didn't want to be the ones responsible for overturning such a high profile murder conviction.
Sure.
When he punted down the line to the higher ups.
It feels like gaslighting. Like, no, you didn't.
Yeah.
You weren't affected by that. Don't look behind the curtain.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, well, why are you even having a hearing on this thing?
Yeah.
If you're going to have a hearing on it, you kind of have to accept the answers to what they are. Reality on reality's terms. If the juror is saying, yes, this affected me, well, then you got your answer. Just because it doesn't go along with a narrative that you'd like it to be, the clear cut, no, none of this affected me. Okay, great, clear cut. We wouldn't be talking about this then.
Right.
And be like, see, it didn't do anything. And they're all claiming it didn't do anything. But there are. They are claiming it did do something, and they're still like, nah, no, it didn't. We got it. It's just kind of stunning how that works.
Oh, it is. And you know, I think personally, just looking at this from a legalistic lens, I think Murdaugh has a decent shot to get a new trial at the Supreme Court level based on this alleged clerk misconduct that affected the jury, and they testified it affected their verdict. That's really, that's essentially the legal standard defense has to meet. Seems like they met it.
But do
it
you
does.
Think there's going to be a different outcome, though? We're going to go through this all over again And we're probably going to get the same outcome, don't you think?
Critical question, Stacey. And it reminds me of the Miranda case. So we all know the Miranda warnings where, like, you have to tell the suspect, hey, anything you can, anything you say can be used against you, right? Remain silent, that kind of thing. Because what happened in that case is there was a horrendous murder. The defendant, Miranda, was accused of it. He wasn't given his rights. He was convicted at trial. The trial was overturned. He got a new trial because of he wasn't read those rights. And at the new trial, he was convicted again and sentenced to decades in prison. So we may very well have the same outcome, but if we do so in a way that also bolsters the credibility and reliability of our and fairness of our system, maybe that's the right way to go.
That's why we're doing it.
Yeah, I mean, that's it's arguing for the procedure, not necessarily the merits of the case yet. There's a time and place, but it's getting to it. Hill's later criminal charges, believe it or not, she got charged with other things that had nothing to do with it, but certainly about perception. Do you think that's going to matter to the judges that she's been charged with other crimes after the possible tampering with the jury? Is that something that they consider when they take a look at the character of the person and, you know, what, when they're really trying to weigh what sort of volume she put onto that jury?
You know, it certainly is a bad look for Becky Hill. And, you know, a judge is a human being. And so they're looking at this and they're saying, hey, did she make these statements? What was her tone? What was her inflection? What was her intention? And then you sort of look at the contextual stuff of, oh, she's also charged with these other kinds of wrongdoings. That could lead someone to sort of lean into the notion that she was a bad actor here and may have substantially contributed to some kind of miscarriage of justice, similar to stuff with which she's been criminally charged.
The defense is also claiming that it wasn't just a murder trial. It was a character trial. There was a week of financial testimony about theft and fraud that the defense is going to say had nothing to do with the murders themselves. The prosecution is going to say it absolutely did. It had a lot to do with the motive of why Alec did allegedly what he did and what he's been convicted of. Prosecutors insist it was a crucial motive and a crucial piece of evidence that the financial storm closing in explained why the murders even happened. Where's that line, though, between relevant motive and prejudicial overkill if we do see a Alec Murdaugh trial round two? The financial stuff has all been settled now. At the Murdaugh trial, I don't believe it had been quite yet. Is that something that do you think would be get brought back up again? Certainly the prosecution wanted as part of their argument for motive. But does it get brought up again? I believe it was even brought up on accident the first time because somebody overspoke and suddenly it opened the door to even bringing all of that into the courtroom.
Totally. So there is a legal principle enshrined within a rule of evidence that essentially says if there is evidence and it might have some relevance, but it's substantially outweighed by the danger of unfair prejudice, then it shouldn't be admitted. Unfair prejudice can be like, oh, we're making this dude out to look like such a bad, like he has such a bad character, which could cause a jury to sort of say, hey, I don't know if they brought enough evidence on the homicide charge, but this guy's a bad dude. Let's let him have it. That's the concern the court wants to avoid. And I think that there was probably some transgressions of that line in the original trial. I think perhaps some evidence of a financial motive would have been appropriate, but prosecutors kind of came out guns a-blazing, spent a week on it, and that might have gone too far in terms of painting Murdaugh like a bad dude and running the risk that the jury would convict him on that basis instead of on the basis of the homicide evidence.
Is there some minimized version of the financial crimes that could be presented where it doesn't literally go into feeling like it's a trial for financial crimes, which is what the last murder trial did, where we're able to present it to a certain point, to a certain line, and certain outcomes may or may not be revealed? But because it is, if you're going to argue this was familiar side and here's the motive for it, the financial crimes have to be a part of it. Do you see a world where if we do see, you know, making a Murdaugh round two, that we're going to have a judge saying, no, this isn't part of it, or here's how much we would let in.
Absolutely. And that happens all the time, Tony, all the time in cases like this, in other types of cases, in child abuse cases, for example, where there may have been, you know, the defendant was accused of, I don't know, mistreating some other child in some other state and some other relationship, you know, years apart from their current accusation. If that comes into evidence, that can be unduly prejudicial. So judges usually kind of make a compromise and they'll say, hey, we'll permit a significant reference to it, but we're not going to go into all the details. And we're also going to limit the instances of alleged financial misconduct. You can talk about prosecution, you know, three or so, but you can't talk about 10 or 20. And I think that limitation was not strong enough in the original trial. And it's, in fact, a ground for appeal for Murdaugh to say that there was too much financial stuff let in. Yeah. If there is a new trial, I think it'll be substantially circumscribed, or at least the judge will be prudent in doing so.
Another big claim that they're putting up here in the grounds, one of the three to the Supreme Court that they're going to decide on, is the investigative claims, which, depending how you look at it, worked for Murdaugh's favor, maybe didn't work in Murdaugh's favor. It all kind of depends. Basically, bad police work, missing DNA tests, no fingerprint lifts. There were some very obvious things that were missed here in investigating a double homicide, where I don't know if it was the local authorities coming in thinking, oh, it's Alec Murdaugh, he couldn't have possibly done this. But in the, I don't even know why that would even come into the equation here. If you're trying to figure out who did do this, them trampling all over this active crime scene, not getting some of these tests done on pieces of evidence that are there. There was a lot that was mishandled. There was a lot that could have been certainly done better. In one way, if it was Alec, well, then right. They never gathered the evidence that pointed to it being Alec. But if it wasn't, they also never gathered the evidence that pointed to it not being Alec. So it kind of works in his favor both ways. If you're trying to figure out who did this, how strong of a grounds do you think they have in this case when it comes to those investigative issues?
You know, generally speaking, shoddy investigation is an argument you make to a jury, not a judge. And you're going to get much more traction with a jury than a judge on that because, you know, just saying like, hey, the police kind of sucked in this case. No appellate judge is going to be like, oh, yeah, the police did suck. I'll give you a new trial. That's not how it works.
Yeah.
However, if it does rise to the level of precluding the defense from being able to conduct their own forensic analysis, to put forth their own experts, that's when this sort of, it's called spoliation or an inability for the defense to really avail themselves of possible helpful evidence. I'm not sure it rose to that level here. You know, I think the firearms could have been retested by defense and there could have been measures taken. I don't think it sort of stripped the defense of being able to argue or do their own DNA analysis or fingerprint analysis or stuff like that.
Well, and the facts here, at the end of the day, Alec Murdaugh is going to be away for the rest of his life in prison on the financial crimes charges, unless something magically changes there, which, you know, who the hell knows. But the odds are not great. He's likely going to be dying in prison, even if, for some reason, the verdict on the homicides are overturned or he gets a new trial and he's found not guilty. It seems that this is more of a matter of record, of legacy, of principle, of not going down before Alec eventually kicks it as being the murderer of his wife and son. That's a big thing. I mean, people wouldn't want to go down for that if you didn't actually do that. If they grant a new trial, critics are going to say technically they freed a murderer. Supporters are going to say that fairness finally won. How does the justice system kind of try and survive both narratives at once, depending on what happens?
You know, I think that it is incumbent upon the justice system to ensure that constitutional rights are observed and that there is a fairness in this process. Even when the defendant is unpopular, unlikable, appears very factually guilty, even under those circumstances, we need to protect these fundamental pillars of the system, because when we begin to allow corners to be cut and folks to be slighted as defendants just because we don't like it that much or whatever, I think we have a tremendous problem systemically. And on top of that, you know, there's crazier stuff has happened, man. We look at the Ghislaine Maxwell case. You know, she was dead to rights. She was convicted. Yeah. Right. And now she's already got a better situation in terms of a more lenient incarceration facility.
She gets puppies. Puppies. Right. She gets puppies. Right.
You know, yeah. And she's posturing towards some additional clemency, which people are saying is at least possible. And so might not be as grim as it might look for Alec Murdaugh. Stranger things have happened, man.
I think that's what he's betting on. I mean, is if he can get the murder conviction overturned, it's one less roadblock. It's one less large brick wall that he's going to have to try and jump over. Because, yes, stranger things have happened. That's the scary part. Stacey, what are we looking at in the comments for thoughts on this area?
So Spinster says, what about the fake unaliving attempt by Cousin Eddie on Alec? Seems like he was thinking unaliving would resolve his issues. So that's one comment.
Yeah, I mean, let's talk about that. Sure. I mean, the unaliving, an interesting move. And what was the true goal all along there? Was it to do exactly what he did, where it was to look like an attempt, or was he truly wanting to kill himself? Cousin Eddie has said, his name
Cousin
is Cousin Eddie.
I'm sorry. I just chuckle every time you say that. Well,
sugar's
full.
Well, I don't believe it is. It's literally Cousin Eddie.
I know, yeah. but I mean,
it literally is Cousin Eddie. Well, we've had his attorney on this show before, but I guess you kind of got to figure out who you're trying to believe there, because Cousin Eddie says, here's what happened. He wanted me to try and kill him, and it didn't work out well. And this is, you know, it was all an act. And Alec is, you know, saying a completely different story. That's another weird aspect to this case that I think a lot of people have forgotten about, that certainly would be important to a jury if this does go back. How do you think that plays under the optics of time?
You know, I think that it inures to the detriment of Alec Murdaugh, because if that information goes to a jury, you know, what they might be thinking is, hey, look, Alec Murdaugh was an attorney. He knows the system. He has a chance at trial, especially if he didn't do this. Why kill yourself? Why not? Go the distance and fight for your innocence and get to that point. Whereas someone who, if they were genuinely trying to kill themselves, that seems like they might have a consciousness of guilt. They might need this to end in that way rather than being in a box for the rest of their lives. I think it's overall is not a good look for Alec Murdaugh.
It makes me wonder how much the drugs did play into it. The way it was portrayed, and again, this is the show. This is the Murdaugh murders, the series that's on Hulu right now. I thought it was interesting how they portrayed it, where it was kind of like a manic drug-induced or drug-fueled, you know, psychotic thought process, basically. And I don't know if psychotic is the right word to use here, but certainly not a decision that a healthy Alec Murdaugh might have made. And it just like maybe the murders, just like maybe many of these other things, the stealing of the money. I mean, how many of these decisions, you know, how many, at the end of the day, did Alec really just make absolutely horrible, completely barbaric self-interest decisions under the influence of these drugs that he was on? Doesn't excuse it, but is that the recipe of Alec Murdaugh and why he unraveled in such spectacular tragedy over the last few years of his freedom?
You know, the drug piece of this, I think, cannot be understated. That is a epidemic in our country, mm-hmm. and the way that it can affect a person, I've seen it firsthand. Mm-hmm. It can completely change a person, and it changes their thought process, their perception. Mm-hmm. It changes their emotionality, their sense of paranoia at times, their decision making. It can affect all of these categories, and so was that at play in some form or fashion in this case? I think it's undeniable that it was.
Well, yeah. I think, watching him, he was so addicted that he was not in his right mind. Who knows if he had just this psychotic episode and thought that his family members were out to get him. I mean, we don't know what really went down in his brain. He just wasn't in his right mind. And now he's obviously clean of drugs. Maybe he doesn't even know what the hell he did.
I wonder that. I do wonder if Alec did it in a drug-induced state, has mm-hmm. no recollection of it, and truly believes he did not do it.
Yeah, he may not even think he did it.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I don't get the vibe that this guy believes he did it. Doesn't mean he didn't do it.
Right.
But I think I get the vibe he believes he didn't do it. Kind of in a Lori Vallow sort of way of just complete divorce from reality of what's going on around you, but able to just kind of talk about reality like they're seeing it, like it's all there, even though, no, those things you're seeing, those things you're claiming happened did not take place the way you are envisioning them.
Well, in his mind, he may think that an innocent man is behind bars because in his mind— he never did it.
Yeah,
he wasn't present when it happened, so he didn't do it.
I know it's fascinating. We'll see where this goes. How long do you think it'll take here for the Supreme Court of South Carolina to make a ruling on these three things that are sitting in front of them?
Different jurisdictions have different timelines on this kind of thing. That being said, with all of the national attention, with all of the spotlight on the case, I think the Supreme Court has a motivation to decide on this promptly. I'm guessing a handful of months. I would think early 2026 is when we get to a place where we'll have some finality, at least at this level of the appeals.
Mm-hmm. And then it goes to oral arguments. If they accept it, if they say, okay, let's hear it, and then they're going to have to argue. And then the court then would decide, is that like the next gateway after that? Is the next gateway a trial? If they hear the oral arguments and say, yes, this is valid, you deserve a new trial, or is there more hoops to jump through?
Right. So if after the oral arguments, the Supreme Court says, hey, Murdoch is entitled to a new trial, it would go back to the trial court. We'd start all over mm-hmm. and we'd have another trial, which would be months and months down the road. If mm-hmm. the court denies the appeal, there are still likely some appellate avenues to be explored, like a sort of a habeas corpus Hail mm-hmm. Mary to a federal court and trying to get some relief on that end. But if the court denies this appeal, this could be the beginning of the end for Alex Murdoch.
Do you think this will have some resolution of some sort in the next year, or are we talking years from now, a new trial?
Yeah, no, I would say 2026 is a reasonable timetable
okay.
for a new trial or a Supreme Court, a South Carolina Supreme Court denial.
Gotcha.
So if they say in the next month or two, oral arguments, then we'll see that probably early next year, and then a trial maybe late next year, early 2020. What are we into? Next year's 27? I almost want to order the popcorn now.
You should.
It might be stale by the time it actually takes place. Eric Faddis, defense attorney, former prosecutor, as always, thank you so much for coming on and giving us your insight into this case. It's very fascinating, as always.
Always happy to be with you.
All right. Let me know your thoughts in the comments section on YouTube. If you're not already there, search Hidden Killers with Tony Brewski. That's where you will find us. Do that same search wherever you get podcasts. And be sure to press subscribe. And like I said, give us your thoughts on YouTube. Until next time, for Stacey and Todd and Eric, I'm Tony Brewski. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Brewski and the Hidden Killers podcast.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Extra Value Meals are back. That means 10 tender juicy McNuggets and medium fries and a drink are just $8. Only at McDonald's.
For limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. Prices may be higher in Hawaii, Alaska, and California and for delivery.